talk a little bit about how we left things last Sunday. It's interesting, even though that was a different unit, there's some carryover. I think one of the major points I tried to make last week, that we are called, like the disciples were, to witness what we've experienced with Jesus. And I think the summary I made on it was, share the good news we have experienced with people we care about. And just remember that, that sort of hangs over the top of this lesson. In that lesson, we named some of the things that we are given or receive as being part of a Christian community. There's a level of commitment that we're drawn to once we've accepted Christ. There is a community of believers that mutually support one another. And there is the constant lifelong learning of the compassion that Christ taught us by example and his words. And I put a few of the things up there from last week that were recommended. If we're going to witness what we have experienced, you need to know the Bible and know what you believe. And believe it or not, that sometimes is hard to verbalize if you haven't thought about that before. What we try to do in here is know the Bible. That's what my calling is, I think, is to help communicate the fantastic content of this wonderful book. What you believe is up to you. I should never try to tell you what to believe. I just need to show you what's there, and then you draw your own conclusions. And in telling people what you believe, you use persuasion, not demanding or demeaning someone. That won't work. And I love the story I told about the salesman and his boss about you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And the boss says, you don't, that's not your job. Your job is to make him thirsty. That's important. And people should know and recognize, we ought to live lives that are obvious. They're different. And I was intrigued by the story that Tim told about his experience in the hospital. When the guy on the other bed in the room said, the people who came to you, see you were different than the people who came to see me. And that led Tim leading this person to Christ. There ought to be something about the way we carry ourselves, live our lives, love with everyone, that people will say, hey, I think there's something right about that. How do we do this? Well, that's what we get into with Paul. I hope one of the things that you get from today is an impression of what it took for Paul to do what he did. Try to put yourself in the minds of Paul and think about the commitment he must have had to do what he accomplished. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But one of the things that this lesson will sort of center on is how do we do this? Okay, we're supposed to do all this stuff. How do you do it? Get some help. That's the bottom line of this lesson. Get some help. Have you ever had one Mormon ring your doorbell? One? No, you haven't. You've had two Mormons at the door. Pat and I were working out in the yard at our daughter's house early this week.
Last week.
Two women got out of the car with their books and their materials and wanted to lead us to Christ. We said we already met him. We're taking care of that. Two of them came. Somebody look up Luke 10, verse 1 for me. We'll do a sword drill. Who's got it first? Luke 10, verse 1. Oh, come on. The teenagers will have it by now.
Your fingers are faster.
I can't.
She's
see
got it.
I can't see who that is.
She's got it.
Jim? Yeah. Get out from behind the post. Jim, read 10:1.
Oh, he's cheating.
I am. That's right. If I was on the, if they were asking me questions on the radio, I'd cheat. Luke 10. But whatever city you enter, and they do not receive you, go out into the streets and say, the very dust of your city, which clings to us, we wipe off against you. Nevertheless, know this, that the kingdom of God has come near you. That 10:10.
What, you know what translation that is? Because that close.
Yes, it's the New King James.
He read 10:10.
He read 10:10.
But I read 10:10.
Oh, 10:10. I want 10:1.
I'm sorry, 10:1. I'll stop. After these things, the Lord appointed 70 others also and sent them 2 by 2 before his face into every city and place where he himself was about to go.
Okay, all right.
That one, I approved that. He sent them out 2 by 2. He sent them out in pairs. There's just something about connected witness that helps the situation of what you're trying to do. You don't ever have to feel like you've got to go it alone. Now, you can, but that's what this lesson's about. Paul traveled with all kinds of people. It wasn't him going by himself to do what Paul did. There are a lot of partners in the Bible. We've got James and John, the disciples. We've got Priscilla and Aquila that we'll talk about next week. We've got Mary and the other Mary in the last days of Christ. Barnabas and Mark traveled together. Paul had Barnabas, Silas, Timothy, Luke, and others. He always seemed to be working with and traveling with somebody else. So that's a clue for us. If we want to be effective in trying to accomplish what we've been called to do, you don't have to go by yourself. I want to give a brief overview of some of these figures. You've heard some of this before, but let's talk about Paul first. Paul was a Pharisee, but was a Hellenistic Jew from Tarsus in Greece. He was a Roman citizen. He was converted on the road to Damascus. He wrote roughly 28% of the New Testament. He's the most prolific author we have in the New Testament. All of his ministry occurred before the disciples wrote anything down. He is the earliest source. Tarsus, this is a small map for Jim and Patsy to see from back there, but here's Jerusalem, here's Tarsus. The distance, the distance from Tarsus to Jerusalem is about 356 miles. He grew up in Tarsus. He was sent to Jerusalem for education and was later an avid opposer of the Christian movement. Let's just walk gradually through some of his timeline. I think that's on the first page of your handout. It's hard to say. Now, I put up here, this is one of the many timelines for Paul. There's parts of Paul that conflict with what he wrote in his letters and what Luke recorded in Acts. So we don't know exactly. You could find other timelines and they won't be like this, but this is the one that I've been using, and today it will be what we use. They think he was born around 6 AD. Jesus was born either 4 or 6 B.C., so that would make Paul about 10 or 12 years younger than Jesus was. It's said that he studied in Jerusalem and became a Pharisee there between the years 20 and 30 of the Common Era. He was present at the stoning of Stephen. He held the coats of the people who were stoning Stephen to death. He was on the strong Jewish side that was trying to suppress and contain this Christian spirit flamed up with Pentecost. After that, and this is the part that gets conflicted, but probably 33 to 36 is when he went to Damascus. He was converted on the road to Damascus, and then the timeline gets real vague, but he says he went to Arabia for a couple of years to just think about what he had experienced. He returned to his hometown of Tarsus between 36 and 44 and ministered in some way, but we don't know what that was like or exactly who was with him. He may have done that on his own. But he had made a friend when he was in Antioch named Barnabas. Barnabas had been sent to minister to the church in Damascus, and he was there and recognized that he needed help. He went to Tarsus, asked Paul if he would come with him back to Antioch, and Paul agreed. The distance from Tarsus to Antioch is about 151 miles. So Barnabas leaves Antioch, goes to Tarsus, said, I need you. Please come with me. You've got the kind of spirit that we need. And Paul agreed to go back to Antioch. After they were there in Antioch for a while, there is the first missionary journey. And it was rather long, 47, 48, a couple of years. And I'm not going to go through the drawing of where that all took. But at the end of that, he was having success in converting Gentiles to Christianity, but there were Jews who thought, that's not appropriate. You need to be a Jew first and then become a become a Christian. It's a branch of Judaism, not... And Paul argued, hey, the Lord's doing it a different way. There's no reason for that. So he and Barnabas go to Jerusalem, probably around 49 AD, and meets with the disciples' leadership concerning the relationship between Gentile and Jewish Christians. And they reach an agreement that he will go out and preach to whoever will listen, but in Jerusalem, we're going to be devoted Jews, period, and what you do on the road is up between you and God. So after that, they go on the second missionary journey of 49-50 AD, and Silas goes with him. There is a disagreement between Barnabas and Paul before this second journey because Paul had a bad experience with Barnabas's cousin, Mark. Barnabas said, I want Mark to go with us. And he said, no, he chickened out earlier. We're not going to take him. So Barnabas and Paul split and go a different way. Barnabas and Mark end up going back to Cyprus. Paul picks up Silas and goes on this second missionary journey. It's too small to note, but you can catch it after that. You follow the line, and it goes from Antioch over into these areas. There's what's called the Macedonian call, where Paul is told to leave Asia and go to what will later be Europe, into Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, and so on, and then eventually back to Jerusalem. The distance from Antioch, well, let's do it from Jerusalem to Thessalonica is 918 miles. Now, there was no trains, no airplane. Even though one artist pictured Paul on a horse, there's no indication Paul ever rode a horse. He walked. And some major sections of it, he would take a boat. But 918 miles on foot, That's commitment. And he's drawn by people who respond and appreciate what his message is. Many are converted, churches are started. And in the second missionary journey, what we're going to talk about today, they end up, well, let me finish Paul's timeline and then we'll go back to say what happens on the second journey. They're back to Antioch or Jerusalem around 50 to 52. He takes the third missionary journey, and several names like Luke and Timothy and others are mentioned at places that he visits. So this is what we call the we passages in Acts, where Luke becomes the narrator and then says, and we did this and we did that, to indicate Luke, the author of Acts, is telling them what he did as part of this third journey. He is successful in all three of these journeys. He comes back with an offering for the poor in Jerusalem in 53, and in a trumped up charge is arrested, spends years in prisons and trying to explain it, ends up in Rome under house arrest, and was martyred probably around 62-63 AD, beheaded. Any questions on that timeline? It's important for you. What I want you to hear is what this man did with help and the commitment it took and how hard, difficult this must have been. Who sponsored? Who paid for this? Who paid for the ship? We don't know. What did he eat? Well, we know he did some work on the way. He was either a, he made tents. He worked with leather. There are several different ideas about what that means, but he would set himself up in a market area, making and selling stuff. And then, by the way, don't you want to come on Sabbath and let me tell you what Christ is about? But think of that. It just blows me away, the commitment that this person had. Now let's talk about Barnabas a second. This would have been the full lesson, but just let me remind you about Barnabas. Barnabas was a Jew from Cyprus. Cyprus is out here. He ends up in Jerusalem. He was one of the earliest converts to Christianity. He was generous in that he assisted people who needed money. He obviously came from some resource. He believed in Paul and was an encourager of Paul, as indicated by leaving Antioch and going over to Tarsus, bringing him back. He was sent to be the pastor at the church at Antioch. He went to Tarsus and convinced Paul to return. They worked together for 1 year. Then they went on the first missionary journey, and afterwards he went with Paul to Jerusalem. They started another trip, but parted ways over an argument about whether to include Mark or not. So that's sort of a big picture of Barnabas. Silas is also called Silvanus. You see Silvanus mentioned in several books. Silas and Silvanus are the same person. He was highly respected as a Jewish prophet in the Jerusalem church. He was the first, he was first mentioned as part of the Jerusalem council. That's where Paul seems to have connected with him. He went to Antioch, so when Paul was looking for a replacement for Barnabas, he selected Silas. Barnabas may have been more of a traditional Jew, while Silas was much more sympathetic to Gentile Christians. And that's a distinction that may have helped Paul decide about who to take on his second trip. Silas was said to be a Roman citizen. I do not understand how he could have been, but yet in the story in Philippi, he and Paul mentioned that they are Roman citizens and they are let out of jail and forgiven. That's another story. He went with Paul on the second journey. Silas found a home in Corinth and remained there as a preacher. He is credited with helping Paul write the two letters to Thessalonica. He was also called Silvanus, and some writers claim he was part of the 70 disciples that Jim Early just read about being sent out by Jesus in pairs to places that Jesus sent them. He joined Peter in Rome and may have helped Peter write the book of 1 Peter. So Silas is an important part. He's literate. He can read and write and is responsible for helping some of the books that we have in the New Testament be written. Later, he returned to Corinth and became the first bishop of Corinth and is believed to have died somewhere in northern Greece. Now, that's dry history, but I want you to sort of get it. I want you to hear who these people are, where they came from, and what they're committed to. Okay, I've introduced Paul, I've introduced Barnabas, I've introduced Silas, and we're going to look at the trip that he takes. Any questions about what I've said so far? Try to stay awake, it gets better. Okay, I would like somebody to volunteer to read that first section on your handout, 17:1 through 17:8. Just anybody that wants. Okay.
After Paul and Silas had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days argued with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Messiah to suffer and to rise from the dead, and saying, "This is the Messiah, Jesus, whom I am proclaiming to you." Some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading men. But the Jews became jealous, and with the help of some ruffians in the marketplaces, they formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. While they were searching for Paul and Silas to bring them out to the assembly, they attacked Jason's house. When they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some believers before the city authorities, shouting, "These people who have been turning the world upside down have come here also, and Jason has entertained them as guests. They are all acting contrary to the decrees of the emperor, saying that there is another king named Jesus." The people and the city officials were disturbed when they heard this, and after they had taken bail from Jason and the others, they let them go.
Boy, there's a lot of stuff in there, and I don't know if you want to play with this passage a lot, but listen to what has happened. First of all, right before this, Paul and Silas are in jail in Philippi. There's an earthquake, the prison doors are open, they are let out, the jailer is concerned that he's going to be blamed. Paul leads that jailer and his family to Christ at that time. He leaves Philippi and goes to Thessalonica and goes to the synagogue of the Jews, where many of the devout Greeks were persuaded. Why? What's going on here?
Well, they were Greek Jews if they were in the synagogue, weren't they?
No.
Oh, they weren't?
Okay. But that follows something. Larry?
Well, it says on successive Sabbaths, didn't say what he was doing in between.
No, but it would indicate he's here 3 weeks, Sabbaths. The devout Jews, you've probably heard this term before. They were referred to as God-fearers. There was something about what was happening in the synagogue that made sense, but they really didn't want to be circumcised. So they would come to worship but not join the church. You ever met anybody like that here? I approached a lady in congregation 3 or 4 weeks ago, and She was a stranger, and I invited her to the class, and she said, "Well, I don't know about that. I just like to come to worship." I said, "Well, are you a member?" "Oh, no. No, I don't like to commit." I said, "Well, why don't you come to Sunday school and learn a little bit about us, and then maybe you can make a decision about it." "Well, I'm just not much of a joiner." But she came to church. Okay, there were Greeks that did that same thing. That said, "There's something about this God that I like. I don't like this circumcision and stuff," but they probably put money in the offering plate if they passed one. And some of the leading women were convinced of this. What was the objection that the Jews spoke about by inviting the Greeks?
They were Gentiles.
They were Gentiles, but Paul is talking about something that's really foreign. The difference was that the Jews could not accept the idea that the Messiah would have been crucified. It's about a reason. The Old Testament teaches us what the Messiah would be. And Paul says he took the scriptures and showed them the places in there that it indicates that Messiah will die and rise again. And that argument was successful, especially with the Gentiles that were in the synagogue. Yeah.
Wayne, there may be a political issue going on here, too.
Yeah.
Julius Caesar, what would it have been, close to 100 years earlier, had given the Jews a special relationship in the Roman Empire. And because the Romans saw Judaism in the diaspora as a philosophy, not a religion.
Yeah.
So Jews had a special deal going on with the Romans, particularly in this part of the world.
Yeah.
So part of this issue is the Jews feel threatened that their deal with Rome could be upturned, turning the world upside down.
Yes.
Meaning we might lose our special situation.
That's good.
So there's a little political going on here too.
Yeah.
Not just theological.
Yeah. I want you to really remember that verse 6. These people who have been turning the world upside down, past tense, who have been turning the world upside down, have come here also. That indicates that these Jews in that synagogue knew Christianity was taking off. It was beginning to blossom. And Paul, the very person that's in our town now, is the one that's doing a lot of this.
Now, they were Judaizers. Have they started following Paul and the other
Christians? It's hard to say. It's hard, but that's an important point, Fred, glad you brought it up. Later, and I don't remember in which missionary journey, people from Jerusalem start following Paul, letting Paul do his work in a synagogue, let Paul leave, and then they'd come in and say, "Now, Paul had a lot of good things to say, but you've got to become a Jew first. You can't jump from Gentile to Christian. You've got to go Gentile to Jew to Christian." And that's what the Judaizers were about. And it's hard to say exactly when that started, but it's prevalent. So, in 3 weeks, he's starting to have some success, to the point that the Jews in the synagogue hire some ruffians off the street to cause a riot and then say, "See what those Christians are doing? They're messing up this place. That's a threat to the peace we have with Rome," and that may tie in with what Tim was talking about. "They're causing trouble. Let's get them." Well, Paul and Silas have disappeared for a minute, and they've been staying at Jason's house. And so the mob says, "Well, if we can't get Paul and Silas, we'll attack the owner of the house where he's been sleeping and eating." So they arrest Jason, and Jason puts up bail, and I don't know what that amounted to or what that worked, but somehow Jason paid a fine of some kind, referred to as bail, and is released. And that leads us into the second part. Any questions about that first part? Because they got mistreated badly 3 weeks there, and as far as I can remember, Paul never returned, but there was a strong church developed in Thessalonica.
Wait, just real quick, Jason is a Greek.
Okay.
So that's a whole issue too.
Yeah.
If this guy's staying with a Greek,
yeah.
Why is this Orthodox Jew staying with
him? Yeah, yeah. Why is this Pharisee?
Yeah, something that's going on.
Good point. All right.
Didn't they play the emperor card?
Oh, they did, yeah. And that sort of touches on what Tim was saying. You're messing up our relationship with Rome, and they're claiming there's another king named Jesus. Well, that's an infringement on the Caesar is our king. He's the leader. We can't have two. That's a violation of the law. Okay, somebody read 10 through 15. Fred, you got it?
Okay. That very night, the believers sent Paul and Silas off to Berea. And when they arrived, they went to the Jewish synagogue. These Jews were more receptive than those in Thessalonica, for they welcomed the message very eagerly and examined the scriptures every day to see whether these things were so. Many of them therefore believed, including not a few Greek women and men of high standing. But when the Jews of Thessalonica learned that the word of God had been proclaimed by Paul in Berea as well, they came there too to stir up and incite the crowds. Then the believers immediately sent Paul away to the coast, but Silas and Timothy remained behind. Those who conducted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and after receiving instructions to have Silas and Timothy join him as soon as possible, they left him.
Okay, again, a rich bit of detailing here. That very night, the believers sent Paul and Silas off to Berea. You know how far it is from Thessalonica to Berea? 50 miles. So they didn't make it in one night. But Luke, in his economy of words, says, well, they went that night and they ended up in Berea. So let me pick up the story there. Bob?
What's the difference of the Jews in Thessalonica and Berea?
Well, that's one of my questions.
Are they a higher class or lower class?
Well, hard to say.
They asked a lot of questions over there.
Notice that Paul did exactly the same thing every place he went. The first place he went was the synagogue. It didn't work very well in Thessalonica, so he goes to Berea and goes back to the synagogue. Paul's got a pattern here, and it's working, but it's not always pleasant. So he goes to the synagogue and welcomed the message. They welcomed the message eagerly and examined the scriptures every day. Not every Sabbath, every day.
Yeah.
So this group of believers in the synagogue were intrigued by Paul's message and said, we need to study this further. Mm-hmm. Don't hear about that Thessalonica. Let's go to Bob's, LA.
My Bible says the Bereans were more noble character than us.
Well, how do they know that? I don't know. I agree.
Just telling you.
I know.
And the first section, the women were high standing.
Yeah.
So maybe the men were the ones that formed the mob or something.
Well, But Bob's question is very valid. It doesn't work in Thessalonica. It does work in Berea. Why? What's the difference?
I think Tim told us a couple of weeks ago, he said that Jesus said, I'll go before you.
Okay.
And the Spirit prepared. Had gone before.
All right.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Paul was following where he was led to go.
The Spirit knew where to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Knew where the receptive hearts were.
We tend to think that Judaism in the ancient world was monolithic.
Yeah.
Everybody
yeah.
believed the same. But that's not so.
That's right.
It's evident in the New Testament and other places. So. The rabbi in Berea, leaders in Berea, they're a different coat, a different minion, use the Jewish word, than the minion in Thessalonica. So to think not that every Jew believed the same thing, every synagogue had the same kind of openness to whatever.
And they generated how many different kinds of Christians?
Exactly.
Dozens. dozens. We like to think that Christianity is the same every place, every time, and always was, and it's...
And still not.
Still not. It's not working that way. Okay, you've heard the story. Okay, put yourself in my shoes now. What are we to learn from this?
You can't sit still.
Okay, does that mean that you and I go to Thessalonica tomorrow, or...
No, two Jews or Baptists believe the same thing.
Okay, all right.
They were persistent.
Yeah.
And didn't give up.
The fact that he had Silas with him, and that's where this lesson's going, is there an advantage if more than one person is carrying the message?
You can run faster than the other.
If you get away from the bear, all you have to do is outrun the other.
It gives you a feeling of support to have somebody with you.
Yes.
But also, you shouldn't give up if the first time you're not received well. You know, it won't necessarily always be the same.
Yeah. Why did Silas keep doing this? Every place they went, they got into trouble. He almost lost his life in Philippi. Why did Silas do this?
He believed it was right.
Yeah, he became as committed as Paul was. Do you think Silas was born knowing that someday he would become the Bishop of Corinth? I doubt it.
He didn't know what that meant.
Pardon?
He didn't know what that meant.
Yeah.
Well, also you think about how devout the people were with whom they were speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
For example, the Mormons talking to you, you're devout.
Okay.
You're less likely to change.
All right.
So if you realize that, it doesn't mean I'm going to tell you one time and it's going to work. And so that should help you realize the consistency of what you are doing.
Yeah.
That needs to be what you do.
Yeah.
Well, I think Paul was so attuned to God and so devout in the Christian world. And I think Silas looked to him, and Silas got weak, then Paul encouraged him, and I think the opposite probably.
That's where we need to go, Patsy. There was a new... Kevin, you raise your hand.
Yeah, just back to that issue of the paired emissaries. In the tradition to which I belong, it's noted that you'll have two types of speakers. One will be the one that captivates and collects people out of the gate. What they say will end up kind of floating away. It's just a service. The other speaker will be less engaging.
All right.
The other emissary, he won't really overtly pay attention to them right away, but what they say will sink in and stick. That's the ideal pairing.
Yeah. I think that's a value. You bring multiple talents that you may not have that the other guy does.
Right.
Let's think a minute about what are some of the advantages that you would find in teamwork, maybe not just one person, but as a group or a class or a congregation. What's some of the things that you think are of value?
There's lots more ideas.
Okay, all right. Ideas.
One person may relate better to others than another person. One might be the thinker and the other one the doer.
Different personalities.
The group may temper somebody who kind of goes off on a tangent or something.
Let's think about, how do we say this? What do they do for each other?
They compliment.
Compliment. Support.
Okay, but...
Yes, support.
I heard support.
Supporting.
All right, thank you. That's what I was looking for.
You're more likely to go work out if you agree to meet some other fellas than if you're just going to do it on your own.
Yeah. Exactly. But when Paul might get nervous, he's got Silas saying doing the right thing. When Silas thinks that we've done enough, Paul might say, no, let's keep going. So there's that mutual encouragement, mutual support Plus, you become committed to each other. If you start out doing something on your own,
yeah,
and think, well, this is a good idea, and you fail, like Thessalonica, well, okay, I think it's time to go home. And the other guy says, no, we started this thing, let's see it through. Yeah, right. So that mutual support.
They are accountable.
Accountable, yeah, very good. That's a really important word, because once you start something together, you feel accountable to what that other person has committed to do with you. So there's support, there's a sense of accountability.
You get confidence. You get
okay, confidence, good.
And you feel safe.
Yeah, I like that.
Anything else?
You know, Wayne, where you have personality, I see more, we're all gifted in different ways. So I think gifted.
Okay.
Giftedness or something.
Well, and that sort of relates to what Kevin was saying, different gifts.
Mm-hmm. It goes beyond personality.
Okay. I should have said multiple personality, but...
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you have multiple personalities, you can have one person.
What's wrong?
Why, if you get put in jail, you've got somebody to pay.
No, I think they were saying, you said multiple personalities.
Some people can do that all by themselves. All right. So I guess that's what the lesson's focused on. Here's an example of Paul and Silas who went together and did support. And you can tell from what I read about Paul. Paul seemed to always need or want or choose to go as a team or a group. If you left here last week thinking, golly, I really ought to be a little more vocal about what I've witnessed and experienced, you don't have to do it by yourself. You can team up, or you can encourage a group to take on a certain mission or a certain project. And if you did anything with the, what we call the April work...
March mission.
March mission, it was fun. Pat and I did a couple of those, and it's fun. And we accomplished something, but I wouldn't have wanted to go out there by myself.
You know, another thought just came in my mind to that is that you said Silas, probably one of us had witnessed Christ. They were apostles.
Yeah.
They had actually seen Christ. And Paul had not. He always made that distinction that he was an apostle because he saw Christ on the road to Damascus.
Okay.
Is that correct? Barnabas and Silas both were.
Well, Barnabas, it's vague. If Silas really was part of the 70, he would have been confronted Christ. I don't know about
confidence.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Silas wasn't Paul, but could Paul have endured without Silas? Well, we don't know because he didn't do it by himself. Are some folks ready to recommend, and well, let's think of this way. Again, trying to liken ourselves to be a Paul or a Silas. I guess the summary is, if you can't be Paul, can you be a Silas?
Sure.
It's like Kevin said, you don't both have to have the same talents and the same gifts. Could you be an encourager to someone who does have that gift? Could you encourage someone who you know has had a rich Christian experience to say, you know, Melanie, I know some of the things that you've gone through. Why don't you and I go tell people about that? Where Melanie might not do that on her own. But maybe I can encourage her, since I know some of her story, to get out and do something in a witness that's strong. Well, we've lost the choir.
no longer preaching to the choir.
No, not preaching to the choir, that's right.
Yes, not preaching to the choir, you're right.
Is there anything, I mean, I've given you a lot of history and geography and stuff like that. I didn't mention maps. I took a lot of time finding those maps on the backside. You can sort of see where he went. What else about this lesson can you take out of here and say, that helps?
We must never minimize the power of community.
Okay.
This lesson talks about, he always goes to synagogue. It doesn't say he went to the marketplace and did one-on-one evangelism. He went to a community.
Okay.
There's a power in the Christian community that we must never take for granted or minimize. We don't realize how powerful our collective witness
yes.
is.
Yes.
Which is so important in this conversation we're having right now as a congregation. What's our collective witness going to be to the community?
Good.
And this so that's real important that I think we keep that.
Yeah, that leads me, Tim's remark leads back to the three things that I said we were all given if we're committed Christians. We've got commitment, and we've got community, and that's what Tim was just talking about, and we're learning the compassion of Christ. So that's one of the things that we've been given with accepting our faith, and here's a demonstration of how community can be more powerful than we can be individually. Let's look at the hidden word. The things that I got out of this was we have an assignment. We need to use every possible way to make that witness effective. If it's by yourself or with someone else or with a group or in a larger setting, whatever way will make that witness effective, we ought to try to find that way. There is power in shared ministry, and Paul and Silas are an example of that. We can never be assured how our messages will be received. We never know if we're going to have a Thessalonica experience or a Berea experience. But the Bereans, they got Paul out of there when the crowd from Thessalonica came and said, don't let them do what they tried to do in Thessalonica. Some of the believers escorted him as far as Athens. That's some distance. They wanted to protect and guard what the person who had brought them this good news. But we can never be assured of how our message is going to be received. It's going back to what I said at first. Our job is not to make them drink, it's to make them thirsty. If you can't be Paul, maybe you can be Silas. We don't all have the same gifts. But the coupling or tripling of that witness can make a big difference. I'm troubled by that fifth one. Will anyone accuse you of turning the world upside down? Are they going to say, boy, if Jewish Barry hadn't lived in our neighborhood, he was up knocking on doors and handing out Bibles all the time. No, they'll never say that. Will anyone accuse you of turning the world upside down?
Perhaps not by yourself, but as
probably
a group.
Probably not by ourselves.
Well, what I'm saying is in today's world, I think we're far more likely to make a difference as a group.
Okay.
You know, one person may not make a difference. Yeah. But if you're part of a group, then as that group,
yeah,
you're making a difference not only within the group, but then as a group within the
yeah.
world.
And, I mean, this is a gloomy way to end the lesson, but folks, we've talked in here. The Christian witness is shrinking. The number of churches are shrinking in this country. They're growing in other places. What we do with our faith is more important now than it was 20 years ago. What we do with our faith now is more important than what we would have been expected to do 20 years ago.
Wayne, I saw a bumper sticker, and I can't quote it, but it meant that organized religion is one of the most dangerous things in existence.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a rebellion against organized religion.
Absolutely. And the other side.
Like a bumper sticker, there must be a lot of them out there.
Yeah, yeah. We are in a state of decline, and it's really important that we are energized by the example of Paul and Silas.
I have to ask, how many of your churches have been co-opted by false prophets? Because after all, the so-called evangelical community is the prime backer of this beast in the White House. And I'm sorry if you haven't gotten it yet.
You're Christians
better off with atheists than you are with false Christians.
Well, the Christians that are making the news are not the ones to admire.
They're Satan worshipers.
Well,
it's plain to anyone with eyes.
He's back.
Get out for a moment. I've been prompted whenever we're studying this part of the Bible. One of the books that meant the most to me in my walk is a book called Christianity Is Jewish.
Okay.
I don't know if any of you have read that. Right now I can't remember the author. It's an older book. It's extremely meaningful.
Okay.
And for me to realize that the background of Christ.
All right, say the name again of it.
Christianity Is Jewish.
Okay.
Yes. And it's easy to read. It's written by a Christian Jew.
Okay.
And my Jewish grew up in Northeast Texas. I didn't know. I knew we.
He knew they were out there.
Not many Jews there. So, but as I got out in the world, I have a lot of Jewish friends and colleagues, and they are really precious to me.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say.
Okay. Good. Patsy, did you have your hand?
Yeah, I heard a quote about when you got out there, know the Bible and what you believe. Know what you believe and believe what you know.
Ooh, okay.
And I think as a Christian, we need to know what we believe.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. We do. There's a verse in 1 Peter that I can't quote, but it essentially says, if somebody asks you why you believe this, know how you're going to answer that.
Wow.
That's a poor quote, but you need to think about what you'd say if you decided you were going to be confronted with someone saying, Patsy, why do you behave that way? Why do you go to church? Why are you so nice? What are you going to say? Know about what that is before. Okay, we are out of time. Thank you. This is mostly history, but I hope you got something out of it. Let's stand for prayer. Father, we've read the book, and we've heard the stories. Now as we leave this place, we're left with what to do with what we know. Help us to go before us like Jesus did and open doors. And give us the courage to walk through that door and tell others what it's meant to know you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
I would add a bit on number 5 and say, the fact that we all put our kids coming out of this world, but we made up a lot of small steps, small contributions, small ways. The bumps come out of the seat.